And welcome everybody. The handouts are going around. Who's got sitting on a pile of handouts? Somebody's sitting on a pile of handouts. Okay, fine.
Excellent.
Yes, that's a very good idea. Then people know where they are. Thank you. The shiur today is very kindly sponsored. Le'ilu Nishmas Rav Shlomo ben Rav Avraham. And it should be an aliyah for his neshama. I am very grateful to be with you today, to be able to talk about this topic. It is a really fascinating topic, and I'm very unlikely to shed any massively new light on this. The reason that I'm looking at this is not to give any kind of halachic decision-making. Goodness me, I'm not qualified on any level to do that kind of psak, certainly not to do any kind of psak. But really to try and understand what our sensitivity should be on these issues. Because we're not making the decisions as to where the Israeli army bombards and takes over and shifts this group and that group. We're not making those decisions, obviously. Those decisions are being made by people who are properly militarily qualified, which I am certainly not. Some of you maybe. I don't know if you have wartime experience. Maybe you do. Officer experience. But that's not my concern. My concern is to try and work out what are the sources telling us as the, if you like, the population who are watching, you know, our army fighting on our behalf. What should we be thinking? How should we be feeling it? And you know, for what it's worth, and I don't profess any qualification on this issue militarily. I personally obviously know many of the, you know, people from my family who are in the army and the officers that I've met. I have no personal doubt at all that the IDF is doing everything that any army should be doing to make the best decisions that it can make. And if you're interested in a professional perspective on that, because mine is not, I've brought you a link there. I listened to a very interesting podcast a couple of weeks ago by Rabbi Scott Kahn on the Orthodox Conundrum. Many of you may listen to his stuff. He interviewed a fellow called Colonel John Spencer. He is not the English officer guy who often speaks on these things, whose name I've just forgotten for a second. That's the one, Kemp. John Spencer is a very senior American military person. He's an instructor in West Point. He has a doctorate in military planning, maneuver, execution, etc., etc. To me, certainly, he seemed like someone who was highly qualified to talk on these issues, and I thoroughly recommend that you listen to that, in which he talks about the military assessment that needs to be made as to what is, isn't proportional, how these things work. It's not what people necessarily think. It's certainly not the way that the news presents it. The news presents it in a way which is sensational for their own agendas. But listening to military people, I think, is the way to go on this. Certainly not individuals who decide that they are world-experienced authorities on this, comedians and who else knows, that speak about these issues without any understanding or knowledge, because everybody has an opinion, right? That's unfortunately not anything close to MS. You need to listen to the people who have the professional training. But for all of us, most of us who are lay people, let's have a look at some of these sources. First of all, war involves civilian casualties. That's absolutely fundamental. It used to involve less, perhaps, than it does now, because battles used to happen out somewhere in a battlefield, and occasionally armies kind of rampage through the home front. Now, of course, the battlefield and the home front are all integrated, and they have been already for 100 years, the First World War and the Second World War. But have a look here in number one. Says David HaMelech, Ki kazo uchaze tochal ha-chayev. Because the sword consumes this way and this way. It just is undiscriminating in many ways. And the Masudas David says, Ki derech ha-milchama hi she'ochelet ha-chayev keheno kehena. Because the way of war is that the sword affects and kills people all over the place. Ukama haloi ma'atim ma'itu. Because as it says, it's often not a small number of people die. Even those who are victorious, even those who are successful, even those who win a war, lose people. People are lost. Civilians are lost. Often people who are innocent, we'll see right now, who didn't in any sense deserve to die. They're part of the war and they're involved in the war. There's a certain amount of undiscriminating reality to the dangers of war. And if you look in Bava Kamma, the Gemara says here as well, Da Amri Inshi, people say, there's a saying, Bahadi Hutsa, together with the thorn, Lucky Karava, the cabbage is also pulled out. What does that mean? That you end up pulling out the cabbage together with the thorn? Rashi explains, Koitz Hagodel Etzel Hakruv. there are weeds that are growing next to your vegetables, next to, in this case, a cabbage, kashibala akro. When you pull out the weeds, you're pulling out weeds. Pamim shenak akro. Sometimes you pull out a cabbage, and it's like obviously not the same. It's a moshel. It's a parable here. Obviously, vegetables are one thing, and people are another. Akruvimo, the cabbage comes out with it. Venimsa lo kebish vilo, and the cabbage ends up being destroyed just because you're trying to weed. Koloma, and the answer to the parable is shchene rosha loikin imoy. People who live with Rishaim, with evil people, end up suffering with those people. Now, that doesn't mean that they always had a choice whether they could live there or not. We'll get to that soon, but there's no question that that happens. Rav Kook was talking in number three in the First World War. Now, the First World War, as many of you are sure, I'm sure, have researched and learnt about, was on a scale which was impossible to imagine. On the first day of the Battle of the Somme, 32,000 men died just in one day. Forget about how many people were injured, so that the level of loss is unthinkable. And Rav Kook was writing, stuck in England, actually, in the East End, in the middle of that war. And he writes, number three, "Kashiyesh milchama gedola ba'olam," when there is great war in the world, "mitorer koach Mashiach." Now he's coming off a Gemara which says that atchalta de geula, one of the things that defines the beginning of a process of geula, and over Shabbos in Kinloss, I spoke at quite some length about the difference between Mashiach and geula. I'm not getting into that now, but let's just call it sort of an end of days focus. That whenever you have a atchalta de geula, it involves, or it can involve milchama, it can involve war. The Gemara says that. And the Rav Kook says, Eta zamir higia, there is a time when people are cut down. Zamir aritzim, where the people cut down are often the wicked people. Harashayim, the chadim in the olam, the rishayim are taken from the world. Vahaolam mitbasem, and the world becomes in some sense refreshed after the war. Not that we'd want it, not that we can possibly imagine it, but it's a reality. Vakolator nishma ba'artzenu, and the voice of the dove, which is the kolator, is the idea of the coming of Mashiach, the footsteps of Mashiach, is part of what comes on the back of that war. Vahayichidim hanesvim belo mishpat, and innocents die without justification. Innocent people will die, he says. Not just the guilty people, not just the rishayim. Because of the upheaval that the war brings in its flood, there is a mitat tzadikim. There are tzadikim that die. Not just innocent people, but tzadikim that die. And they are mechaper, they bring a kapara. Olim hem lamala b'shoresh ha'chaim v'atzmut ha'chayehem. Their life is not sacrificed in vain. They bring a kapara, they bring bracha to the people. El klal binyan ha'olam b'chol erchav muvnav. The achakach ketoma milchama. And afterwards, when the war is finished, mitchadesh ha'olam baruch chadash. Wars are terrible things, but after the war, there is a sense of renewal, a sense of new beginning. V'raglei Mashiach mitgalim b'yoter. And if you think, you know, back to the 20th century, which is not that long ago. Actually, it's longer ago than you sometimes imagine. It's 25 years ago. The wars that happened in the 21st century, unbelievable, 20th century, unbelievable wars, the First World War, the Second World War, brought in their wake unbelievable steps forward in different ways, especially the Second World War, which really was a continuation of the First World War. But still, there is a new start. Ulefi erka shel godel milchama, the proportional to how great the war was, b'kmutav eichut, in quality and quantity. So Rav Kook, in his typical style, sees in the destruction of the war an opportunity for a new start, even though he's living in England when the death toll was coming back to him and many, many, many Jews, obviously non-Jews in England, but many, many Jews in England dying for Germany as well, for England, Jews fighting Jews, firing at Jews. It was a real bloodbath on every level. And he writes, nevertheless, that the war brings with it a metaphysical angle to it, too. And I brought some considerations at the bottom of the sheet here about civilian deaths. Obviously, things that you've all thought about, how proportional the things need to be. How do we distinguish between the tzaddikim, the innocent, civilians who are completely innocent, children, babies, civilians who are not combatants but will assist the enemy, so they're not tzaddikim in this sense because they are enemy civilians who will work against our armies, and then people who look like civilians who are simply combatants without uniforms. One of the most difficult things, of course, in fighting a terrorist organization is they're not following the rules of international war. They're not wearing uniforms. There is no distinction between civilians and non-civilians in the way that they look and walk, etc. When it's legitimate to attack a military target, when it inevitably results in civilian deaths, is there a difference if the hostile forces are hiding behind civilians and using them as shields? This is all discussed. We'll see some of these sources. And also very important for us, halakhically, where do we get our sources from? You can't look this kind of stuff up in the Shulchan Aruch. It's not there with Hilchos Shabbos and Hilchos Kashrus. Where are we going to find sources? What about Tanakh? Is Tanakh a legitimate source? We'll see, yes, in many ways, for how we view these issues. We are fighting now and living in a world, the last 100 years, certainly in the state of Israel, but the last 2 years specifically, where biblical-level events are happening. The way that the war is, and I'm not trying to become, you know, messianic and eschatological and apocalyptic and all that. I'm just saying that on any kind of level of how this is being assessed, we are pretty much living in Tanakh in many ways. They would be writing Tanakh about, you know, the way that we're living. And that's very complicated because you can't look up those things in Shulchan Aruch because the Shulchan Aruch deals with a different kind of war, a different kind of situation. Are there halachot of war? Where do we locate them? Etc., etc. So let's look at some sources in the sheet. So, first of all, let's talk about proportionality. And again, I'm not making psak on anything that the IDF shouldn't do, not for me, but to help us understand what's going on. So there's a Gemara in Erevin. Am Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Nochrim Shitzaru al Yerot Yisrael. So non-Jews who come to fight against Jewish cities. You have to respond proportionally to them. You don't, if they come and, burn down the barns or something like that, you don't send the army out with weapons against them. And you can't justify breaking Shabbos to fight against, okay, these people are dangerous, they're trying to cause property damage and maybe even loss of life, but you can't pull out the whole army on Shabbos and fight them on that. Tanya Namehach is so too in a Brisa, Nachrim Shitzaru, etc. B'mam Dvarim Amurim, when does this law of proportionality in that way apply? K'shibam Aliske Mammon, if they're coming for money, if they're coming to steal the livestock, to burn down the barns or whatever. Aval Bao Aliske Nefashis, but if they are coming to kill people, to actively try to kill people, of course then proportionally you have to respond with weapons. Yotzim Alehim B'Klei Zainim, you have to go against them with weapons to respond. U'machalim Alehim Es HaShabbos, and you're allowed to, obligated to, not allowed to, break Shabbos in order to respond because they're coming to kill people. Then it says, U'be'ira smucha l'sapar, but on a city that is by the border, meaning when it comes to people raiding the borders of the land, there's a different consideration. Proportionality works differently because that is actually an existential issue. It's not just someone who's been targeted. They're trying to push back at the borders of the country. Even if they only come to steal wheat, or to steal hay, or to steal, stubble or whatever, yotzim aleim mechalei zayin mechalei misa Shabbos. Then you do not respond in the same way as if they just came to burn down a barn. This is the borders. They are coming with a longer-term goal, which is to undermine the yeshuv, and therefore you respond to them even with weapons, even though they didn't come with weapons. You even break Shabbat, and the Shulchan Aruch paskins that for them. And the Ramah adds in, you can see the beginning of 5 in your own time, but the Ramah adds in, when the halacha is brought in Shulchan Aruch, even if they haven't yet come, but you get intelligence that they're coming, and you want to put a preemptive strike out to them, we realize that they're intending to come. If they're on the borders, we are allowed and indeed obligated to respond, or to preempt, I should say, with disproportional force to prevent that from undermining the yeshuv. Now, are any of these sources relevant to our situation? And, Rav Rimon has spoken about this many times in our shul. The answer is probably no. These are written for individual Jews. These are written for individual householders and livestock holders. We are now dealing with countries and wars, again, from one state against another state or a proto-state. Are these the same considerations? Maybe to some extent, maybe not to the entire extent. And what are the political, sociological, strategic, tactical considerations that you consider when responding? Meaning the principle here is already that the direct proportionality is not as relevant when the overall picture is much more serious, who assesses that picture? At the end of the day, not rabbis. That picture is assessed by people who are military, politicians, and then you get into the, well, who can you trust? What do the politicians do? What are their agendas? Are they listening to the military people, or are the military people listening to them? And obviously, it's very complicated, and everyone has their conspiracy theories. Oh, they're only doing because of this, and they're doing because of that. But nevertheless, the source is very clear that one has to take into account more than just six people came over, so we can only send six people back. And by the way, when I made that reference here to this fellow who was on the Orthodox Conundrum, what was his name again? I can't remember. Spencer, John Spencer. One of the things he said on that podcast is that proportionality is not decided by how many people they killed and how many people you killed. He said it's just a complete misnomer. It's a complete misnomer. It's not how the military works. Proportionality is assessed by how many people they expect may be killed and the level of the target. Obviously, when you're about to take out a major commander, which will have a major tactical impact on the war, it's entirely reasonable, he said, again, not my field, his field, to justify a much larger number of civilian deaths because of the nature of the task and the goal and the target that you're undertaking. And therefore, it's not about who dies in the end. It's about what the commander would have assessed at the beginning with all those factors being taken into consideration. And therefore, it's a complicated issue. And halakhically as well, you see here that you need to take into account not just the numbers, but the impacts. Okay, there's another source which is fairly not helpful, but I will bring it up just to kind of push it out. There is a source here, number 6, the Amar Shmuel, Malchus de Katla Chad Mishita. If a government kills up to 1/6 Ba'alma of the world, Loi Miansha, they don't get punished. So there's a certain level of a sixth is okay. More than a sixth is not okay. But there's no clear consensus as to what exactly that's talking about. Is that talking about how many people the government can draft into the army of the country? You know, you can draft in about up to a sixth of the population, but not more than a sixth. Is it talking about the enemy combatants killed? In which case, why is there a limit of a sixth? Is it talking about how many of your own side can you justify? How many of your own soldiers? And I brought you various different responses to that. Who is the melech? Rav Kook says a melech in today's world is the government. That's a fairly clear idea, and that has certain halakhic implications as well. But at the end of the day, it's not clear what this 1/6 relates to. I only brought it because I wanted you to, you may see it. It's an interesting source, but it's not got much relevance to the issue of civilian casualties in practical terms. Okay, let's just go over to page 3. I'm not going to read through all these psukim because I know you've seen many of them before. There are certain precedents in Tanakh for war. There are precedents for war. There's a war against the seven nations, where the Torah says, when you go out to war, if it's not the seven nations, if it's more distant nations, you must offer them peace. And if they make peace, that's fine. And if not, you can kill who you need to kill, but kill all the men, but you don't have to kill the women, etc., etc. But if it's the seven nations that are in, if it's the Milchemet Mitzvah to kill the seven nations in the land of Israel, then the key words at the end of Source 11 is Lo Techayeh Kol Neshama. You may not leave anybody alive, men, women, children, etc. So too in Amalek, the parameters of Amalek is very clear that you may not leave anyone alive. The war against Midian, where Midian has to be fought against because of what they've done to the Jewish people. So too, if you remember the whole story in Bamidbar, Moshe brings the soldiers bring back the women, they bring back the children, they only kill the men and not even all of the men, and Moshe is very unhappy, etc. Is that relevant? No, it's not relevant. Go over to page 4. All of these discussions about biblical wars, Milchemet Amalek and Milchemet Shivat Ha'Amamim, even though they are Milchemet Mitzvah, and the war that we have, I'll shut the door. And the war that we are fighting today is also Milchemet Mitzvah, and in that sense there is an overlap because they come under the same broad war category. They don't have the same halachot, and I brought you here Rav Goren. I brought you Rav Goren because I wanted to bring you the most, like, extreme you'd expect general. Rav Goren was very clearly one to prioritize the success of the IDF. He was the general of the IDF. He was the chief rabbi of the IDF. He was later the chief rabbi of the country. And look at what he says in number 14.
ein lilmod mihen. We may not learn from them, meaning the ancient wars in the Bible. Chas v'chalila al milchamot achirot v'al zmanenu. So no one who is saying, oh, this is Amalek, and Amalek, you have to kill every person. This is not relevant. This is not relevant l'halocha. And the rabbis of the IDF and Rav Gorin, who is the one you'd most expect, not relevant. So don't bring Amalek, you have to kill everybody, and don't bring the Shiva Sa'amim. It's not the same thing. We're not fighting those kind of wars. We're fighting a Melchemet Mitzvah, but it doesn't have the same halakhic parameters. Again, where are you getting the parameters from? Good question, but you can't just whip out the Chumash and say, well, look, it says here you have to kill everybody, this is what we have to do. Not relevant lahalocha, certainly not decisive lahalocha. In terms of Melchemet Mitzvah, I brought you in number 15. Just let's look at this source. I just mentioned it. Ein ha-melech nilcham tchila ela Melchemet Mitzvah. The government, let's call it the government, the melech is only allowed to initiate on its own a Melchemet Mitzvah, meaning if it's not a Melchemet Mitzvah, if it's not an obligatory war, they have to consult with the Kohen Gadol and the Urim V'Tumim, etc., which we don't have. But a Melchemet Mitzvah, they can initiate. Ve'ezehi Melchemet Mitzvah, says the Rambam. What is a Melchemet Mitzvah? Zo Melchemet Shivat Amemim, the war that we fought against the seven nations to conquer the land of Israel. Milchemet Amalek, the war we fought against Amalek. The Ezrat Yisrael Miyad Sar Sheba Aleihem, and saving the Jewish people, the Jews, against enemies that come upon them, is, if you're doing it with the Jewish army, Milchemet Mitzvah. So 99%, I can't put a percentage on it. The vast majority of poskim, who you will discuss this issue with, will say that the wars that we've been fighting since 1948 in Israel have been a Milchemet Mitzvah. Certainly the current war, which is a response to an invasion by Hamas, and of course everything is always, there's always a stage before and a stage before and a stage before, but you'll find very few people who say that it's not Milchemet Mitzvah. Of course, it's not 100% watertight, and if you are having a discussion with somebody about the relevance of the Haredi draft, which I think is a perfectly reasonable discussion to have if you can have it in a civilized and a normal manner, even though it's a very important issue. I actually don't think it's worth arguing this point of Milchemet Mitzvah, because you can always pick holes in it and say, well, it's not completely clear that it's a Milchemet Mitzvah. The truth is, even if it were not a Milchemet Mitzvah, which I think only a small minority of poskim would say, there is nevertheless a clear impetus for drafting at least some people in the Haredi community, based on halacha. I don't think you can make a case to the contrary which is persuasive. But I'm not talking about that now. Let's assume it is a Milchemet Mitzvah. Says Rav Gorin, number 16, Milchemet Mitzvah, hinei chova mekudeshet min haTorah. This is a holy obligation in the Torah. It's one of the 613. HaMitzvah al ha'am lelo yotze min haklal. It is a mitzvah without any exceptions. Limsorid nafsho, to give up of themselves. Lema'an ha'sagat matzorato shel ha'milchama, to achieve the goals of the war. Lelo hitchashvut im ha'korbanot benefesh ha'adam. You can't sit and think in advance about what will the sacrifices be. Shel milchama zot tavit v'ikvoteha, that the war brings in its wake. And I just spoke in there just now about women in the IDF, which is a very interesting topic. Rav Gorin clearly includes women in this mitzvah of Milchemet Mitzvah, but that doesn't mean necessarily that he would say that, and he talks about this explicitly, that all women have to go out in a combat unit and fight. He's saying that everyone has to do what they are best equipped to do in the context of who they are and what they can do, etc., in order to win the war effort. Nobody is excused from that. Ein od mitzvah acheret asher b'kocha ledchot et kol ha-mitzvot shel Torah. There is no other mitzvah that pushes off all of the mitzvahs in the Torah. Kolel mitzvah pikuach nefesh. Obviously, pikuach nefesh is completely pushed aside when it comes to Milchemet Mitzvah. And that's what gives it its own gedder. One of the things that we've been talking about in Israel over the last year and a half is these halachot of Milchemet Mitzvah and where they come from and what they mean and how they work. The soldiers do not have halakhic permission to do certain things on Shabbat because of pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh is a civilian, non-wartime parameter. They have those heterim because of Milchemet Mitzvah, and it's different. And therefore, you can't just apply regular life, peacetime, halakhic parameters to the war. It's war, and war has its own halakhic rubric, and that doesn't always come from the place that we tend to go to for halakha. So Rav Gorin is very, very clear. It is a Milchemet Mitzvah, but you cannot bring the precedence from Amalek. Who can you bring from? So I want to talk to you about Shimon and Levi. Remember the story? Shimon and Levi go out there to avenge the terrible rape
of their sister. There's no question that their sister has been kidnapped. She's been abused. She's been raped. And they now go to the people of Shechem and they trick them. And they manage to beat them in a battle. But they don't just kill Shechem and Hamor and their personal guard. They wipe the whole place out. They wipe them all out. And Yaakov responds to them very forcefully and says to them, how could you do that? Now, what does he think they did wrong? That's an important question for us to ask. And of course, they respond to him, how could we not do that? We're going to let them take our women and rape them in the way that they did. What do you expect us to do? Just sit there and cry? And who gets the last word? Well, in that story, it's not clear who gets that. Well, the brothers get the last word. He said, how could you? And he said, well, how could we not? But later when he gives them all a bracha, when Yaakov gives the brothers a bracha, so the bracha to Shimon and Levi is not such a bracha. And he actually curses their anger, their attitude. So he kind of gets the last word that it was wrong. What was wrong with it? So quite a well-known debate. The Rambam says in number 17, the Ketzad Mitzuvim Heim Al Hadinim. What does it mean that the non-Jewish world and part of the seven mitzvahs are obligated to create their own legal system? Chayavim lahoshiv dayanim shoftim b'chol pelech o'pelech. They have to have a rule of law wherever they live. Ladun b'sheish mitzvahs elu, to have the six Noahide laws, obviously not to murder, not to steal, not to etc. etc. Lahazir et ha'am, and to keep the people, enable the people to keep them. Uben Noach she'avar al achad misheva mitzvahs elu. Any non-Jew who breaks these seven mitzvahs, yehareg b'sayif, is obligated in the death penalty. It's an all or nothing thing, he says, when it comes to the sheva mitzvot. If the non-Jews break the mitzvah, it's the death penalty. Umipnei zeh, and then he gives his parshanut. Umipnei zeh nitchayvu kol ba'alei Shechem hariga. And that's why all of the people of Shechem were liable to be killed. He says it was just that they were killed. It was the right thing to do. It was justifiable. Shehari Shechem gazal, because Shechem, the leader, kidnapped this woman and raped her. Vehem ra'u, and they saw this, v'yadu, and they knew it, v'lo danuhu, and they did not bring him to justice. Meaning there were a lot of them, and there was one of him, and they could have done something, couldn't they? He said they could have overwhelmed him, they could have had a revolution, they could, I don't know, whatever. And they didn't, and therefore they're all complicit. They're all basically in agreement that they didn't care about the rule of law. You can kidnap people, you can rape people, and therefore they're all together punished. Not because it's a collective punishment, but because they're all individually responsible for that. Now, let's just go over the page. I've put some thoughts on here on page 5. That obviously assumes, the Rambam assumes, that they could do something about it. And it's not always clear that you could do something about it. How responsible are you when the people of Germany elected the Nazis in 1933 in a quasi-democratic process? Okay, it was pretty democratic. So they chose that government. Now, they had their reasons for choosing that government. Many Jews voted for that government as well because of other circumstances. And in the end, it turned out to be an unmitigated disaster on every level for them and for humanity. Now, are the Germans in 1943 responsible for the Germans in 1933 that voted for Hitler or not? Now, there's nothing they can do. Now, they can't get him out, etc. And I don't know the answer to that question. The Rambam is assuming in that analysis that these people could have got them out. They could have said something, and they didn't. How does that apply to the Arabs living in Gaza with Hamas? I have no idea. I'm not an expert on politics within the Gaza Strip and how that works and what choices people have. Obviously, there was an election of some kind in which Hamas was elected, but that was a long time ago. How does that apply? I don't think it's a rabbinic discussion to have. But that's the Rambam's position, that the people are responsible, and that's why they could have killed them. And by the way, that implies that the people were not responsible. He couldn't have killed them. On the other hand, there were definitely children there who were killed, and they didn't do anything wrong. But the children fall within the responsibility of the parents. If the parents make decisions which impact on their families, then that's on the parents. And of course the children are always innocent, but the children are, you know, brought into positions by their parents' choices. Question?
I'm trying to understand how this is relevant to nowadays for two reasons. Number one, because when people die in Gaza, it's not judicial killing.
Right.
Right. Anyway, nowadays, you go to execute.
It may not be relevant. It may not be relevant, but it is a discussion. It may not be directly relevant to halakhic, to our case, but it's a precedent that can be discussed as to under what circumstances can people be killed. Now, you could turn around and say,
whatever they did, even if the Rambam says this, Yaakov disagreed. So why did he disagree? Meaning, even if the Rambam says they deserve to be killed, so what's with Yaakov? Yaakov also doesn't think that way. So it could be brought into a precedent the other way in saying that even if you could make it relevant, it's not something you can rely on because we end up deciding against it. None of these fit exactly with our situation. We're not dealing with dropping milk in chicken soup here. We're dealing with a much more broad issue. And again, I'm not trying to get to a psak. I'm trying to get to how are we going to think about this. The Ramban, in number 18, which I'm not going to read you the whole thing, he rejects the Ramban. He says that at the end of the day, the civilians haven't done anything to Yaakov and his family, number one. And why are you looking for, you know, the fact that the civilians in Shechem were complicit in the rape? The people of Canaan were breaching any number of the Sheva Mitzvah, says the Ramban. They were living an immoral life and their sexual transgressions. You don't have to go looking for things to find fault with. The Psukim talk all about these nations. What was the problem? He says the problem was that Shimon and Levi were not judge and jury. Meaning, even if these people, and this kind of speaks to your point a little bit, even if you would have said these people are liable in some way, then what Shimon and Levi did was wrong because they were not appointed as a judicial process to execute them. They went in and they did this and they were criticized for this. So there is, I think, a relevance to this in the way the Ramban is looking at it. Rav Hirsch is very important. Look at what Hirsch says, number 19. Here begins the part deserving of censure, and we do not need to cover it up. Had they killed only Shechem and Hamor, the brothers would certainly have been in the right, but they did not spare the unarmed, defenseless men who were at their mercy. What is more, they looted the city. They made all the inhabitants of the place pay for a crime committed by their master. There was no justification for this. Their one reply, Hachazon Naseh Tachotenu, reveals their motive. The lord of the manor would never have taken such liberties if the maiden in question had not been a foreign, friendless Jewish girl. This, though, makes Shimon and Levi realize that there are times when even the family of Yaakov will have to know how to wield the sword in defense of purity and honor. They wanted to make others fear them, so that no one would ever dare to do such a thing to them again. Nevertheless, by killing innocent people for a crime committed by the high and mighty, Yaakov's sons went too far. Interesting. Again, how does that apply today? I'm not sure. But it means that we don't have to be uncritical of, I mean, the Torah itself is critical. It's not us being critical. The Torah itself is critical of the act. And Rav Hirsch understands that where people are indeed entirely innocent, they can't be killed. The question is, again, who is innocent and who is not innocent? And we'll see a little bit more of that. I brought Rav Yisraeli at the bottom there. That says there's no way we can have a collective responsibility in that sense. In practice, there is insufficient basis to permit action against an entire community that has failed to execute its duty and remove murders from its midst, so long as it's reasonable to excuse them for the claim of fear, pressure, and the like. And therefore, he's talking more to Misa, practically speaking, that there are situations where the civilians are just not able to take any action. There's just nothing they can do, and therefore, you cannot hold them, in that sense, responsible. An important part of this discussion is the Maharal. The Maharal justifies Shimon and Levi by saying this is not the action of two individuals against other individuals. This is a military operation by one country against another country. It was Yaakov's family and the proto-country of Am Yisrael against the city-state of Shechem, which is not just a group of people, it's actually an independent political unit, and therefore the Maharal says that it justifies actions taken, even where there are innocent civilians killed, if it's needed, because one country has to fight against another country. But again, how does that apply? And I brought you in the footnote there, even though people quote the Maharal a lot, other people see it as a minority viewpoint, which cannot be used in order to just justify anything. But it is an interesting question as to what is legitimate when a country is trying to fight another country. It's not just about this person was innocent, this person was innocent, this person, too many people. It's about a much bigger tactical plan. And that becomes relevant, says the Maharal, when you're dealing with these global political decisions. And at the end of the day, military action is an extension of the political need in order to do that. So the Maharal's opinion is very important. You should read it, think about it, see how it works, etc. A couple of other things. King David was told that he wasn't able to build the Metamigdash. Why? Because he'd spilled too much blood. And the Radak says, what was the blood that he'd spilt that was unjustified? And he said, well, there's certain things were certainly unjustified. He killed Uriah, or he had him killed, or he enabled him to be killed, and that was completely unjustified. So too with Nov, he was indirectly responsible for all the Kohanim of Nov being killed. What about all those other people he no doubt killed in the wars? Says the Radak, and you can read it in your own time, so he wasn't criticized for that, because that was a justifiable act of war. You cannot have a war without killing other innocent people. It's not like Uriah HaChiti, where he was complicit in his death. Nevertheless, he says that the people who, the fact that he did that, and he fought those wars, and he killed those people, even though he was excused for doing that, still he can't be the one to build the Beis HaMikdash. There's an interesting question: if a Kohen kills somebody by mistake or even justifiably, can they still do Birkat Kohanim? Can the vehicle of Shalom be brought about by somebody who has killed people even justifiably? There's an interesting discussion about that, and obviously very relevant to our times when there are Chayalim going back and forth all the time in the war, and many of them are Kohanim, etc. And you can look into that separately. I want to pick up on a couple of other things before we finish. The Rabbi Bleich, let's look on page 7 for a second. And then I want to talk about international law and then maybe bring it to a close. Again, there's way too much to talk about in 45 minutes, but we can only do what we can do. Let's look at Rabbi Bleich in number 29. The idea of a nation fighting against another nation. Were war to be sanctioned solely on the basis of the law of roideth, of pursuit, military action would perforce be restricted to situations in which the loss of life is inflicted only on armed aggressors. Meaning, if there's a roideth, you can take out the roideth. You can't take out the roideth and his family and everybody around them. Or upon active participants in the war effort. Military action resulting in casualties amongst the civilian population would constitute homicide, pure and simple. However, not only does one search in vain for a ruling prohibiting military activity likely to result in the death of civilians, but to this writer's knowledge, and Rabbi J. David Bleich has about as much knowledge about these things as anyone could have, there exists no discussion in classical rabbinic sources that takes cognizance of the likelihood of causing civilian casualties in the course of hostilities legitimately undertaken as posing a halachic or moral problem. And this is really what we've said before. Obviously, there has to be some kind of a limit. There has to be some, but that limit is going to be a military limit in many ways. But the idea that you're killing innocent civilians has never, he says, in halakhic literature, been quoted as a reason to prevent a war action by one country against another country. Again, it's not based on rodef. Rodef, like pikuach nefesh, is private halacha between individuals. These are not the right principles to bring in. This is not what is being discussed here in a halachic scenario when dealing with war, and therefore he says, we do not find anywhere that it says that innocent civilians, by virtue of the fact that they're innocent civilians, cannot be killed in a military operation. It just doesn't exist. There are different rules of war. I brought you the Nitziv at the top of the page that says that the rules of murder apply in civilian peacetime. The rules of killing people are different, obviously, when it comes to war. That's true in international law as well. People can do things in a war, legitimately under international law, that they would not be allowed to do as civilians, obviously. And he says, and that's clearly relevant in halacha as well. So let's just talk about the issue of international law, and then we'll draw it to a close, at least an intermediate close. There is a view, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli brings this view, that actually in today's world, the relevant halachot of war are the halachot, are the rules of war that the international community has accepted. And a little bit like parallel to the idea of Dina de Malchus Adina, when it comes to monetary law, we say that the law of the land in, you know, fines and taxes and things like that becomes the halakha. So too he says that the international law of the world becomes the halakha, but, and he says it's very important, not insofar as it's theoretically on the books, but insofar as it's actually implemented. And that always is the case with Dina de Malchus as well. Meaning the traffic, the traffic speed limit is 30 miles an hour. If you drive at 31 miles an hour, are you guilty of gezel? You're stealing use of the road. You're abusing that right to be on the road. It says no, because people all the time drive at 31 miles an hour, and the police don't care. Nobody cares. The cameras don't care, and therefore it's not a law that is relevant. It's theoretically a law, but it's not really a law. So too, he says that look at the international laws of warfare and look at how they are applied in practice with other countries in the world. And that is the system, if you're importing international law, that will be relevant for the Jewish people and for the IDF. Now, that's a very interesting question.
How are the international rules of law applied in practice? And people will say things like, well, you know, people will say, look at what they did in the Second World War. You know, they bombed innocent civilians and they dropped a bomb in, you know, Hiroshima, etc. And then the answer will be, well, that's not how war works anymore. To which the answer will be, well, how do you know? You've never had an existential threat to your country and had a war. So how would that actually be applied? It would be interesting to speculate how countries of the world would actually fight in practice if indeed they were invaded by people who killed tens of thousands or proportionally the same number of their people and raped them. How would that actually work in international war terms? Not theoretically everyone sitting behind a desk talking about like their moral principle. How would that work in practice? Good question. I don't know. I hope we never have to find out. But it is a good question. So what are the intermediate conclusions? Well, you may say that you've just left more confused than you arrived. And I don't blame you. I've given you some things to think about. There's no question that that it doesn't have to be proportional. Have a look in Shaul Yisraeli, giving him almost the last word. Number 31, then we'll finish. The outcome of this, he says, is that there is room to permit missions of revenge, reprisal against our enemies, and this is considered Mechamit Mitzvah. Any tragedy that occurs to our enemies, their partners and their children, is their responsibility, and they carry the weight of those consequences. There is no reason to refrain from action against the enemy because of the concern that innocents will be harmed, they are the reason of these results. Obviously, there is no room for permitting harming children intentionally, and one should take care not to harm them. Obviously, when no one is suggesting that there should be an intentional targeting of civilians qua civilians, but a legitimate military consideration, and Avram Shapira says this in number 33 as well, a legitimate military consideration taken given the military factors that will inevitably result in the loss of innocent civilians is halakhically permitted, as long as those civilians are not being directly targeted and that it's a justifiable action militarily. And then you end up with the question of how many innocent civilians are justifiable in order to protect the lives of soldiers? Meaning, we could do an operation which kills less civilians, but far more of our own soldiers are killed because of the attempts to protect those civilians, which of course is, you know, a lot of what the IDF is doing, telling people in a building they're about to be bombed before they're bombed. I mean, I don't think that's what they did in the Second World War anywhere. And therefore, it's going to cost us more soldiers' lives in order to protect civilians. Now, says Rav Shapiro, okay, that has to be part of the cheshbon, and we are going to go out of our way to protect civilians. But, he says, don't just think that the loss of two or three or four soldiers is an acceptable loss because you've saved more civilians, because the loss of soldiers has an effect on the country and the army as a whole. He says, and therefore, it's always a more complicated, it's never about the numbers, he says. And therefore, if you say, well, we may risk three or four soldiers if we protect more civilians, he says, don't underestimate the impact of, God forbid, the death of those soldiers on the wider population and the army as a whole. It may be a bigger factor than you think, and therefore not appropriate to save those civilians in order to protect those soldiers, etc., etc. So there is a lot to say. I've referenced a lot more books here as well. There has much been written on this. There's a very wonderful book by Rabbi Shlomo Brody called The Ethics of Our Fighters, which is an excellent, excellent book and has chapters and chapters and chapters on this. Other people have written about it at length. I recommend that you read those. But hopefully this has given you at least some pointers as to where they're looking, what they're looking at, and how they're drawing these ideas. And I think we as the people, you know, listening to this war and sitting, you know, no matter where we're sitting, right there or the sidelines, we have to find ways of processing which are not just influenced entirely by the news, etc., but by values of Jewish thought and practice. So happy to talk about it more. And sorry, we went a few minutes over, but hopefully that's okay too. Okay, thank you.